Welcome back from the break, everyone. So the next talk will be given by Monica Schleyer-Smith from Stanford, and you can see the title. It's Engineering Quantum Spin Models with Atoms and Light.
Well, thank you for inviting me to participate in this School on Ultra Quantum Matter. I have to admit, actually, when I received the invitation, I had to start by Googling what ultra quantum matter is. And there's a very inspiring description on your website. But one of the things I sort of took away from this is that largely, I think, this idea of ultra quantum matter, much of it is about forms of matter dreamed of by theorists that have yet to be realized in the lab. And so as an experimentalist, one of the dreams that I have is that I might one day in my lab have some kind of a device, the quantum mechanical equivalent of an arbitrary waveform generator, where I can press some buttons and you can tell me I'd like to realize this Hamiltonian because it should give rise to some very exotic form of matter. And I can just press some buttons and program it in and we can play with it together. So we may have a long way to go to realize this goal. But you know, it's not so crazy to think about when one looks at actually the current state of the art in terms of building programmable quantum systems in experiments with laser-cooled atoms. So here are a few pictures from around the world where it's become possible in recent years to, for example, program the positions of individual atoms in optical tweezers and one-dimensional, two-dimensional, even three-dimensional systems like this Eiffel Tower here. And so this is an extraordinary level of control enabled by basically having very good control over some laser beams in the lab. Now, in order to go beyond sort of making pretty pictures, the additional ingredient that one needs is to turn on some interactions between these atoms. And in particular, one needs to turn on interactions that have a range that is long compared to sort of the characteristic length scale on which we can trap and manipulate these atoms with light, which is set by the optical wavelength on the order of a micron. And so actually the topic of my talk today will be how can we use light to start to taking advantage of the amount of control we have over laser light to actually use light to program the interactions between atoms. And so for most of my talk, I won't be showing pretty pictures like these ones at the top. I'll be talking about a somewhat messier setting of a cloud of atoms, a sort of gas of laser-cooled atoms. But I'll be talking about using light to program the interactions between them in two different physical systems. And in particular, in the one system, we can use light to turn on interactions that are long range but still have a sense of locality. They're interactions that extend over a range of a few microns, and that's by coupling atoms to highly excited, highly polarizable Rydberg states. And in the second experiment, we actually have the ability to realize very exotic and highly non-local interactions by letting atoms talk to each other in a way that is mediated by photons in an optical resonator. So just to give a sense of some sort of motivating directions for this research, what sort of interactions would you want to program into this function generator? We're motivated on the one hand by asking, can we design interactions that allow us to engineer specified entangled states that might have some applications in perhaps enhanced sensing or computation? We're interested in being able to build up model systems inspired by areas ranging from condensed matter to quantum gravity, where you might have some idea that a particular Hamiltonian is interesting, but we really want to build it and simulate it and find out what happens. And I would say this field of ultra quantum matter largely lives in this corner of quantum simulation, but can also perhaps give inspiration for sort of the more applied side of engineering entanglement, or also asking, can we engineer quantum systems where the form of interaction maps onto perhaps some classical problem that we actually want to solve because that's of technological relevance. So can we encode certain optimization problems in finding the ground state of some quantum many-body system? Okay, so, and I'll touch on all of these applications throughout the talk, but I'll start just sort of as a warm-up with a simple example, kind of a simple motivating example from this bottom section of classical optimization, so not yet ultra-quantum. So just to give an example of, you know, what type of model might you want to be able to build in the lab, let me give you an example of a classical problem that you might encounter if you're the organizer of, let's say, a summer school with parallel sessions, and you have a bunch of students, and they have different lectures they want to hear, but they only have, each student sort of has two possible slots in which they can hear a lecture. So they can hear a morning lecture and an afternoon lecture. And if you'd like to optimally schedule these lectures, what you might do is, for example, draw yourself a graph where each vertex on the graph is one of the lectures that students might want to hear. And the edges are weighted by the number of students who want to hear both of these lectures, right? So if a lot of students, if it's a heavy weight on this edge, a lot of students want to hear both of these lectures, then I would like to place one of them in the morning and one of them in the afternoon. So you will directly see that this looks like some kind of an anti-ferromagnetic interaction, right? I could think of red as spin up and blue as spin down, and if there's a heavy weight on the edge, I want these spins to anti-align. In the sort of the classical optimization world, this is called the max cut problem. You want to sort of cut the maximally weighted edges and in order to divide this graph into the morning and afternoon classes. But in sort of more condensed matter language, this is a problem of minimizing the energy of an Ising model with some kind of a long range, potentially non-local couplings. And if we want to bring in quantum mechanics, and it's an open question whether quantum mechanics can help with this type of problem, but if it is going to help, we're probably going to need to bring in some non-commuting terms into this Hamiltonian, perhaps a transverse field, right? And then if you can build this in the lab, just these anti-ferromagnetic Ising models with some long-range interactions and a transverse field, maybe you can start to investigate this open problem. Okay, so the ingredients that we would need would be some, let's say, atoms in which we can encode a spin, long-range interactions, and a way of programming the couplings between the spins. Okay, so let me start with by introducing sort of our first candidate system for generating these long-range interactions. And this is the system of Rydberg atoms. So a Rydberg atom is an atom in a state of a high principal quantum number that's extremely polarizable. Just to sort of draw an example, this is the blue dot represents a cesium atom in its ground state. The big red circle represents a cesium atom excited to an n equals 43 state. The area goes as the square of this principal quantum number, and the strength of the van der Waals interaction between two of these atoms scales as n to the 11th power. So you can, it turns out that this, if you can excite to these states, that's a way of getting very strong interactions on a length scale of a few microns. And actually this type of approach has already been applied to realize highly entangled states, to study actually topological spin models. So this is a system where there have been a lot of exciting developments in the past few years. There are actually a few different ways of using these Rydberg atoms and encoding a spin in them. So you can encode a spin on the, sorry, this picture is a little messed up, but you can encode it on the transition between the ground state and the Rydberg state, that's a blue and a red here, or within the Rydberg manifold between two different Rydberg states. Something we've been working on in our lab is actually encoding the spin on the transition between two ground states. So these are two stable states. Ordinarily, they're non-interacting. But the idea is if you turn on some light that off-resonantly couples one of these states to the Rydberg manifold, it can give you a way of sort of controllably introducing interactions between the atoms. And I would say this is perhaps less advanced than these two approaches I drew here on the top. But the exciting possibility here is that it really gives a lot of flexibility for using the light field to dynamically and even spatially control the structure of interactions. So we have been investigating this approach in initial experiments, essentially in the setting of a gas of atoms. So we have a gas of atoms that's optically trapped, where we shine in a laser that illuminates some region of this gas of atoms. And the basic idea is that we encode a spin, again, into ground states of these atoms, and have this laser couple one of these atoms to a highly excited Rydberg state in a manner that is off-resonant. And what this does is if the two atoms are far apart, that off-resonant laser causes an energy shift on the spin-up state. So there's some energy shift of the spin-up state, which, however, gets modified if the two atoms become very close together, essentially because the detuning of this laser So if the atoms are very far apart, there's an energy shift due to this off-resonant light. And there's some contribution to that energy shift that gets suppressed if the atoms are very close together because of the impossibility of simultaneously exciting both atoms. And so sort of as a function of distance, if I look at the energy for a pair of atoms, at some critical distance where the interaction energy becomes strong, this energy shift is suppressed. And so this coupling to the Rydberg state introduces an effective interaction among the ground state atoms. And that effective interaction has kind of a plateau-shaped form. It's flat out to some critical distance and then falls off. And the net effect then is actually essentially an Ising interaction that is turned on by this laser field. Okay. So that's the principle of it. And if we want to check that it works, one thing we can do is, as a starting point, just initialize our gas of atoms in some spin polarized state. And what I've shown here are actually just different, the dots are different possible orientations of this initial spin polarized state. We consider different states along sort of a meridian of a block sphere that represents the polarization in this gas. And then we turn on our laser field, and when we turn on the laser field, the effect that we see is that actually we see a precession of the average magnetization at a rate that depends on how many spins are up. And we can understand this in kind of a mean field picture as this Ising interaction resulting in an effective field on each atom that depends on whether the surrounding spins are pointing more up or more down. So this is precisely what you'd expect from this Ising Hamiltonian. And the fact that we can understand it in this mean field picture is related to the fact that it's relatively long range, that each atom is sort of interacting with tens of surrounding neighbors in the gas. Okay, so what I've shown here is actually kind of the local magnetization in some region of a cloud of atoms. We can also ask how this behavior depends on position in the atomic cloud, because I told you we're using light to turn on these interactions, and light gives us some spatial control. And so in fact, if you ask, again, I'm always initializing different possible sort of tilts of a spin polarized state. And I can ask as a function of the initial tilt, what is the acquired phase? And that's a strength that measures the strength of the Ising interaction. So in this 2D plot, the phase is shown as the color, right? And so if I have something that's red on the bottom and blue on the top, that means there's this strong twisting effect that quantifies my Ising interaction. And that's strongest here, somewhere where our laser intensity is highest, and then it falls off as the laser intensity varies. So this shows kind of the optical control of the interactions. Okay. Now, I should mention one of the reasons why seeing these dynamics is interesting is that, you know, I've shown you mean field dynamics, but if one is able to measure the effect on the quantum fluctuations in the atomic cloud, and this is something that we are intending to look at, then one expects actually that these same dynamics take the quantum noise and squeeze it in a way that reduces the uncertainty of the magnetization in some direction. And these are states that have applications in enhanced quantum sensing. Now, one limitation, so this is a mechanism for generating entanglement. The interactions are relatively short ranged. And so if one wants to generate long range entanglement, it turns out with pure Ising interactions alone, the correlations will never sort of spread beyond the range of interaction. So it turns out that adding in a transverse field, I motivated that for other reasons earlier, but adding in a transverse field is something that might be a useful ingredient to, for example, allow correlations to spread in the system. So we decided, still looking at these mean field dynamics, to ask, can we engineer now a transverse field Ising model? So the basic approach that turns out to be convenient in our system is to realize this model in a sort of a Floquet implementation, which is to say, we alternate between turning on the light that induces interactions and turning on a coupling, it's a microwave coupling between these two spin states, that's effectively a transverse field. And if we alternate quickly, then essentially what I'm doing is, I think the first talk used the word trotterize. I'm sort of trotterizing a Hamiltonian by breaking it up into these two parts and alternating between them to realize really effectively the equivalent of just a static transverse field Ising model. And so we can check whether this is working by again asking sort of what do the mean field dynamics of this system look like. Okay, so and I'll mention in the current setting of our experiment, the time for which we can sort of implement this Hamiltonian is relatively short because the atoms are not particularly well confined. There's some atomic motion that limits the timescales, but we can nevertheless for a few cycles implement this transverse field Ising model. And what we see, well, okay, so here's a boring example that I'm putting here first, which is if we have no interactions, then I'm plotting here as squares different possible initial states of the spin polarization in the system. So different possible initial tilts of the local magnetization. And we turn on our transverse field, and not surprisingly, what happens is that the spins will precess around the x-axis. So that's shown by these different trajectories here. And one way of kind of thinking about this is there's one fixed point in this diagram, which is along the x-axis, and that also represents, is equivalent to the ground state of this Hamiltonian. If I turn on Ising interactions, we can ask how this picture evolves. And what we start to see is that rather than the dynamics consisting of precession about this single fixed point, we start to see precession about two new fixed points that are essentially the two ferromagnetic ground states arising from the fact that we have, in this case, ferromagnetic Ising interactions. So what we're essentially doing here is kind of using the dynamics to tell us something about the ground states of this system, and observing that once we turn on the interactions above a certain critical interaction strength, we see this single ground state split into these two ferromagnetic ground states. Okay. And one kind of nice aspect of this experiment is it turns out that in order to vary the interaction strength here in these three pictures, what I've actually done is just take advantage of the fact that in a single system, I have a spatially varying interaction strength set by the local intensity of the laser field. So again, kind of benefiting from the optical control of the interaction. So the green here is showing the local intensity of the laser field and corresponding interaction strength. The brown is showing the strength of the transverse field. And I've again shown you here a sort of a color plot where I say as a function of the initial tilt of my block vector, that's the vertical axis here, this theta, what is the acquired phase, that's the color, versus position in the cloud. If at a given tilt, there is no accumulated phase, that will be white on this plot. And that is precisely an indication of sort of where the fixed point of the dynamics is. In the wings of the cloud where the interaction strength is weak, I have a single fixed point, and then once the interaction strength reaches some critical value, that splits into these two new fixed points, illustrating essentially in the dynamics a signature of this phase transition from paramagnetic to ferromagnetic. So that's, I think, a nice illustration of some of the capabilities of optical control of the interactions. We control the structure of the interaction spatially. We can also control it in time. And that has actually a number of neat applications, I would say, in this field of ultra-quantum matter. So for example, what I've shown you so far, we're using this kind of Floquet transverse field Ising model to mimic just a static transverse field Ising model by rapidly switching between interactions and the transverse field. But actually, if you realize essentially variants of this model now in a 1D spin chain instead of in this sort of disordered cloud of atoms, this has a rich phase diagram where in the regime where we're rapidly alternating between the Ising interactions and the transverse field, there's this essentially phase transition from paramagnetic to ferromagnetic. But if one starts to change the time scales of this modulation in the Hamiltonian, this system can also give rise to symmetry protected topological phases with no equilibrium analog, so intrinsically Floquet topological states, as well as time crystals. And so this actually, we collaborated with Ashwin, who's here as an organizer, on understanding the prospects for realizing these Floquet topological phases in these Rydberg systems. And now we have some of the first ingredients to start to implement that. Another sort of intriguing direction that I learned about sort of right as we were doing these experiments is that there's theoretical work asking what happens if I have a 1D spin chain and I have a periodic alternation between some Hamiltonian, well, let's call it H naught, which is just the interacting Hamiltonian, and a version of that that is deformed in a way where the whole Hamiltonian is scaled in a sort of sine squared profile like this. And I saw this and it reminded me a lot of the interaction strength that we have that's spatially varying as a function of position. And intriguingly, it turns out that in this type of a system, there's some fascinating dynamics that can occur where spin excitations are essentially attracted to two points in a way that can be understood by thinking of this system as having space-time curvature. And in fact, these two points look exactly like black holes with a Schwarzschild metric. And I think Ashwin's group has been doing some work on understanding actually the entanglement between these two singular points in space. And so I think there are some really intriguing opportunities here for combining the spatial and time-dependent control of interactions to explore exotic states of matter. I showed you a ferromagnetic interaction, but also when one starts to go to the anti-ferromagnetic regime and do this in the setting of individual locally controllable spins, this naturally maps onto these problems in frustrated Ising models and optimization. So those are directions that this can go. At this point, I've sort of introduced our first physical system, and I'm going to pause and ask whether there are questions about this before, for the remainder of the talk, I talk about realizing perhaps even more exotic, long-range, highly non-local interactions in a cavity QED system.
So does anyone have any questions? If you have a question, you can raise your hand in Zoom, and then I can unmute you so that you can ask Monica the question. I'll give people just a moment to do that. All right, we have some, Matt, you're unmuted. You can go ahead and ask your question.
Okay, I was just wondering, just to clarify what the different interactions you can realize in this first setting, like the type of power laws and things like that. Thanks.
Sure, yeah. So the interaction that I showed you is one where in the tail, sort of the long range tail of the interaction is a 1/r⁶ interaction because it's a van der Waals interaction that scales as 1/r⁶. But it has actually the sort of unusual feature that at short range, the interaction versus distance is actually ideally flat. It can depend a little bit on the details of the Rydberg state one chooses, but the sort of simplest interaction potential one realizes by this off-resonant dressing method is something that's flat out to a particular critical radius and then falls off as 1/r⁶. And I emphasize this fact that it's flat at short range because particularly in the anti-ferromagnetic case, I think that's potentially interesting for realizing systems that are highly frustrated. And one can even ask about in a lattice system, can I tune, for example, the ratio of the nearest to the next nearest neighbor coupling by tuning what the lattice spacing is relative to this range of interaction. If one wants to go beyond that, another natural direction is to realize interactions that scale as 1/r³. And that can be realized by directly working with atoms in the Rydberg manifold where one has actually a dipole-dipole interaction. And there are also ways of kind of using this dressing technique and, for example, harnessing what's called a Foerster resonance, which is a near resonance between an S state and a P state that gives rise to a 1/r³ interaction over a longer range. One can actually also sort of modify the tail of this dressing potential. So I would say, yeah, the most natural power laws are 1/r⁶ and 1/r³. And But I think I'll just add to that that the opportunity of controlling the laser frequency gives some potential directions for doing things like actually making an interaction that changes sign as a function of distance. So I would say there's actually quite some versatility in the form of the interaction that could be explored.
All right, so I see that there's one more question. This one was typed into the Q&A, so I'll just read it. So the question is from Marvin Chi, and it is, what is the order of magnitude of the number of controllable atoms?
Yeah, so, I guess there's a question of what you mean by controllable. but if I would say sort of the most exciting directions are going from what I did here, where there are sort of thousands of atoms, but they're just kind of in a gas that's not particularly well controlled, to something where one has an ordered array, or perhaps also a disordered system, but with some programmable disorder. And so that's sort of using these tweezer technologies that I showed on the first slide. And there, the sort of state of the art is 1D chains of order 100 atoms, or even in recent work in the Harvard group, they're working actually on two-dimensional arrays of, I think, hundreds of atoms. And then there's also some work, like the Eiffel Tower example I showed, of three-dimensional arrays where the question is sort of starts to become how large a defect-free array can you make? And so people can arrange, order 1,000 atoms, but not yet in a defect-free way. That's probably the biggest challenge in scaling is how many of these atoms can you trap in a way that you always have every site filled? But I think, of course, even 100 is getting to a regime where we can't just calculate things, right? And so I would say these are really exciting tools for quantum simulation.
Good. Thanks. I think we can move on to the next topic now, probably.
Sure. Yeah, great. So I so far described these interactions that come about by van der Waals interactions and they're somewhat long range, but nevertheless sort of limited to the few micron scale. I'm going to now introduce a second system where we actually have the ability to have atoms talking to each other kind of over up to a millimeter length scale in a way that is highly non-local, because what we do is we couple the atoms to a delocalized mode of light. And so just to sort of give, one reason you might want this is that I mentioned before, in, for example, these optimization problems, you'd like to have some non-local graph of couplings. But just to give sort of a second motivation from the field of quantum simulation, non-local quantum systems show up in the context of asking, can we build quantum systems that have holographic duals? And in particular, I first learned about this in the context of asking, how can you model the process of information, quantum information, becoming scrambled in a black hole? So there are toy models for this process, Hamiltonians that one can write down, that have the feature that they involve highly non-local forms of interactions. I think you'll probably hear in Subir's talk later today about the Sachdev-Yekataev model, which involves fermions that can hop and interact over in a sort of random non-local way that results in exponentially fast spreading of exponentially fast scrambling of quantum information. So this is a fascinating model theoretically, in the sense that it is understood to be dual to a black hole. I don't know how to build exactly this model in the lab, but I think it's an interesting question to ask, can you build models of a similar flavor and learn something, even though we can't exactly calculate what they will do, perhaps learn something by building them in the lab and simulating their dynamics. So something that we can do that's in a similar flavor is build systems where we don't have fermions that can hop non-locally, but we do have spin excitations that can hop non-locally. And so the basic concept is that if I can engineer some kind of a spin exchange interaction, up-down goes to down-up, I can think of that as a spin excitation that hopped. And if I can use a photon to mediate that process, then this hopping can be very long range, okay? So the concept is what I'd like to do is take, let's say, an atom in the spin up state and convert that into a spin down atom and a photon. So it flips its spin and emits a photon, and then another atom should absorb that photon and flip its spin. And then because the photon can, you know, easily travel very far, I can now generate a long range spin exchange interaction. Okay, that's kind of the concept. To sort of have some control over this interaction, we'd like to realize it in a slightly fancier scheme than what I showed you before, which is I'd actually like a setup where I can have a control field that drives a two-photon process. One atom absorbs a photon from the control field and emits it into a resonator, where a second atom absorbs that photon and then re-emits it into the drive field. And so this allows us then, in principle, to controllably turn on a spin exchange interaction that can be as long-ranged as this resonator mode is delocalized. Okay.
Monica, I just wanted to let you know we have 10 minutes.
Oh, okay. That is good to know. So, okay, good. So, and I'll mention these sort of long-range photon-mediated interactions are, you know, not entirely new. They've had applications in engineering entangled states and also in sort of condensed matter-inspired quantum simulations. One new ingredient that we focused on realizing in our experiments is the ability to really locally observe the spin dynamics. And so just to give an example, so this is actually what the experiment looks like. Here are two mirrors. Light can bounce back and forth between them to mediate interactions. And as a starting point, we just trapped a sort of millimeter long cloud of atoms and said, if I initialize the system with some spin excitations in some region of the cloud, so horizontal here is position in the cloud, vertical is time, and then turn on the light, I can ask, where do those spin excitations go? And in fact, we see that we can generate these spin exchange interactions. In this particular experiment, they showed up in as these spin excitations hopping over from this region A to this region B and back. You might ask sort of what determines where they go. And so far, this is actually just set essentially by the spatial structure of the cavity mode. So the local intensity of the cavity mode at two given positions dictates the strength of interaction between those positions. And from that type of a model, we can understand very well the dynamics of the spin excitations in this system. Okay, so, but I said at the beginning that I wanted to describe a system with programmable interactions. And what are some things you might want to program? Maybe you'd like control over the sign of the interactions. Are they ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic? The form of the interactions. Do I have these spin exchange interactions that I can think of as spin excitations hopping over long distances? Or maybe also these Ising interactions that we talked about before. And perhaps I'd also like some control over the spatial structure of the interactions beyond just having couplings that are dictated by the local intensity of the cavity mode. If I want to realize a spin chain, maybe the system I described before is better, but the cavity naturally lends itself to having completely non-local all-to-all interactions, and maybe we can even be fancier, and I'll touch on that at the end. So, okay, but as a starting point, we said, let's start by asking about the form of the couplings, flip-flop versus Ising. This, and I'll mention this was motivated to some extent by a collaboration with a group of Ehud Altman, where they asked, if you just take this general sort of form of non-local interactions, where the form of the coupling is the product of local couplings to the cavity mode, what is the dynamical phase diagram of that system? Can it scramble quantum information? The short answer is no, it's not a fast scrambler, but nevertheless has a rich dynamical phase diagram. But one of the knobs that they said is important for exploring this phase diagram is the ability to control the strength of the Ising versus the spin exchange coupling. So we realized actually that's something we can do. And it turns out that all it takes in this system is to control the orientation of a magnetic field relative to the cavity axis. The rough intuition is that the magnetization of the atoms couples to the polarization of the light, which acts sort of like an effective magnetic field on the atoms to introduce the long-range interactions. But by rotating a real magnetic field relative to the cavity axis and letting this real magnetic field be our quantization axis for the spins, that actually then dictates sort of which spin components couple to the cavity and interact. Okay. And so here we're just showing as we vary the angle of the magnetic field, we can actually control the Ising coupling that's shown in blue here, as well as the spin exchange coupling, and turn one or the other off or on, or realize, let's say, an isotropic model where they're equal. So the form of the couplings is dictated by the angle of a magnetic field. We can also actually control the sign of the interaction. It turns out that's controlled just by a laser frequency, right? So here you also have the curve with the opposite sign. And just to briefly give a flavor of how we measure this type of thing, the type of experiment we're often doing is looking at the dynamics of the system. So for example, to measure Ising interactions, we can initialize some spins that are pointing down, which should produce sort of an effective field along Z about which the other spins precess. And by measuring the phase of all the spins, we can map out that spin precession. And the speed of the precession tells us the interaction strength, and the sign of it tells us the sign of the interaction. And so we use that to sort of map out the Ising and spin exchange couplings in our system. But you know, when I talk about, let's say, seeing that we can have a ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic interaction, you're more often not thinking about the sign of the direction in which spins are precessing. You're actually thinking about what are the ground states of the system or the low energy states of the system. So we thought, you know, we would maybe cross-check this by looking at the low energy states of the system by slowly quenching on interactions in the presence of a aligning field. So okay, so just as a starting point, we can do an experiment where we have no interactions and ask, as I turn on, let's say, some combination of a Z field and an X field, and I measure the polarization of the spins. So this is as a function of the tilt of my magnetic field. Not surprisingly, I see the spins go from polarized down to polarized up. But if I do this in the presence of interactions, and this is in the case of ferromagnetic Ising interactions, I see all of a sudden a much sharper edge where the spins all want to align down or all want to align up with each other, right? That's due to the ferromagnetic interaction. Anti-ferromagnetic interactions cause the opposite effect. And we can summarize this in some measurement of the magnetic susceptibility of our system, which, as we reach a critical interaction strength, starts to diverge to within the resolution of our experiment. Okay, and so that's a ferromagnetic Ising model. Interestingly, if you do the same type of a measurement varying the strength of XY interactions, you see exactly the mirror image of this magnetic susceptibility plot. And there's actually a sort of straightforward way to understand this symmetry, which is that to the extent that I have sort of many atoms coupling to this single cavity mode, to lowest order, I can think of them perhaps as forming sort of one big spin that I've called F here. And basically, if I have, so this Ising interaction roughly looks something like Fz squared, but that's almost the same as an XY interaction of the opposite sign, up to some term that depends on the total spin. So one thing we were curious about is actually we don't necessarily want to be restricted to the case where the system is acting like a single big spin. We might want to be able to do many body physics in the system. So can we do any measurement where actually we see a difference between Ising interactions of one sign and spin exchange interactions of another? It turns out that we can. And one thing we can do is actually look at the dynamical response of the system to an inhomogeneous field. And okay, so the top plot here is something where there's a magnetic field gradient across the system. The color represents the phase, and it's winding because of the magnetic field gradient. It turns out that if we turn on spin exchange interactions, that phase winding is actually completely suppressed. But this only happens with spin exchange interactions and not with Ising interactions. And one way to understand that is that these Hamiltonians are almost the same up to some term in the Hamiltonian that has to do with the total spin. In other words, there's an energy gap between manifolds of different total spin, and this gap suppresses any effect that would dephase the spins and reduce the total spin. So this actually is an effect that potentially is interesting in applications, for example, in quantum metrology, where one wants to use light to engineer entanglement between the spins, but also preserve the coherence of the system. This can help with that. Okay. Do I still have a few minutes? Okay, nobody said.
Sorry, you have 1 minute.
Oh no. Okay. So okay. So I have to show you. Okay. So I might use two, because I want
That's
to
fine.
Say two things. So okay. Everything I showed so far, sort of, we can understand in a fairly semi-classical picture. So first, I want to show you that there's something quantum going on. And one way we can do that is actually work in a spin one system. So we actually, our ground state in rubidium has three magnetic sublevels, minus one, zero, and one. And one neat thing we can do is initialize all atoms in the zero state, turn on the light, and you know, watch what happens. And it turns out that what happens is, if you measure the populations of all three states after some time, you'll see that, first of all, you'll see kind of large fluctuations in these populations. These are just different repetitions of the same experiment. But whenever we see atoms in the minus one state, we also see atoms in the plus one state. And this is a manifestation of a process of basically forming correlated atom pairs by having you know, one atom flip to the plus one state when the other atom flips to the minus one state in this spin exchange interaction. So, okay, so this gives a mechanism for forming correlated atom pairs. It's fairly similar to effects that can be realized by direct collisional interactions in spin one systems, but it has the neat feature that these interactions are mediated by light, and so they can occur over sort of millimeter scale distances. And so one thing we've used this for now is as a way of actually sort of asking, can we start to control the spatial structure of interactions and the spatial structure of the resulting correlations in our system? So so the idea is, actually, let's go away from that sort of messy system of a single cloud of atoms and go to an ordered array. So here's an array of 18 little ensembles of 1,000 atoms each. And the dream is to start to be able to control, actually, what are the correlations in the system as a function of distance between sites in the array. So can we start to control the interactions and the resulting correlations rather than just have every atom or every ensemble talk to every other? Okay, so there's a trick for doing this, which involves subjecting the system to a magnetic field gradient. I turn on a magnetic field gradient, and this process of flip-flopping, or of generating a correlated atom pair, is no longer resonant if the spins are far apart, right? The energy of this configuration is not the same as the energy of this configuration. So if we look at spatial correlations between the plus one and the minus one atoms, they're only correlated at a particular distance, which ideally might be zero. It turns out in our system, there's a small offset, which has to do with the energy difference between the plus one and minus one states on average and the zero state. But we see this shortening of the correlation length in the system that says we've turned off the long-range interactions. And now we can controllably turn them on again by changing the frequency spectrum of our control field. So if I have two frequencies at a certain distance, that turns on interactions at a certain distance. And so we start to see correlations appear sort of away from this diagonal. Okay. And now, as a function of the frequency separation between these drive fields, you expect the correlations to occur at a corresponding distance. This is theory. This is a very recent experiment showing, in fact, that we see correlations at a distance that is set by the frequency spectrum of the drive field. And this now generalizes to where, in principle, a multi-frequency drive really enables arbitrary control of sort of translationally invariant couplings in the spin model. Okay, so if you want to read about some of the applications to what I might call ultra-quantum matter, here's a theory paper on sort of taking that technique and applying it to realize some toy models that could give rise to fast scrambling and unusual emergent geometries due to controlling the graph of interactions in the quantum many-body system. Okay. So with that, I've probably spoken too long, but I hope I convinced you that optical control is quite powerful for programming the form, the sign, and even the spatial structure of interactions. We've already shown some, you know, useful effects where interactions can protect spin coherence. And we're very excited about sort of taking these tools and applying them to various directions in quantum simulation, from non-equilibrium phases to toy models for quantum gravity.
All right. Thanks very much, Monica, for a great talk. I think in the interest of time, we're probably going to have to move into the break now, but I'd encourage everyone to remember your questions or think of some more for Monica during the Q&A session at the end of today's program. So Monica, thanks again. And now we'll have a break. We'll come back at 1:45 Eastern time for the next talk. So that's just about 15 minutes. So see everyone back here soon. If you'd like, you can log on to Remo again during the break.